Thank you for coming along. We're going to talk today about as it says on the, hopefully what it says, project cost control. It's going to be the basics of project cost control. We've only got 2 hours. We can't do much more than the basics in 2 hours, but we're going to do a couple of exercises, and during that time, Paul and myself will be wandering around, so please grab us if there's a particular area or anything that you'd like us to get focus a bit more on. We'll also both be here for the rest of the day, so you can always catch us up and ask us some questions. Paul is the expert, by the way. I'm good at speaking at these events, but Paul knows what he's talking about. So we're trying to, between us, we should make a good double act. Okay, so welcome. I'm Simon Springate, for those of you, there are a few of you and I recognise in the audience. I've been in project controls for quite a few years now, working for CH2M. Spent some time recently in Qatar, a couple of years in Qatar as the director of Qatar Rail Planning, and then went off for a year in South Africa in Johannesburg, worked in gold mines for just over a year, spent a lot of time in Ghana. That was quite an exciting time. But nowadays I am, for the last 18 months, look after project controls for Europe for CH2M. CH2M has had tremendous success in the area of project management, particularly in Europe this last few years. Not all down to me, of course, but you know, I'd like to. Project controls has done rather well, but I've worked in project management for nearly 35 years on project controls, particularly for most of that time. So got a bit of knowledge around how to do project controls. Paul, go on. You can.
Hi, Paul Tucker. I similarly know a few of you. So what am I? I'm head of program controls on the Tideway program at the moment. So that's a £3 billion sewer that's going to run through the middle of London. Before that, I did the sister project, which is spelt wrong up here. It's actually LEE Tunnel, Lee Tunnel. It was a £700 million, again, sewer system. Before that, the spelling London Underground. Been in controls basically since I come out of university. So. About 15 years now, I guess. And one little bit, you'll see it pop up at some point, I'm a massive Arsenal fan, so that's part of the reason I'm here.
Paul doesn't normally do presentations, so when I told him he had to do one for development and it's at the Arsenal station, he has his own seat out there. Right?
That way,
son. Oh, sorry. That way, yeah. Sense of direction. So we both worked for London Underground. I left and worked for a gold mine. He came and worked for a sewer. I don't quite know. So what is cost control? Now, I can be quite direct about cost control, mainly because my boss is the CFO, so the finance officer, or an accountant, in other words. And cost controllers and accountants don't tend to get on too much because they talk about different things. So this is why I'm describing this. So for the word finance, read accounts. Cost control, mapping estimate to the schedule. You're taking the cost and you're making it fit to the schedule. So you're putting it against time. It's not simply budgeting for the year. You're really interested in the work that's been done. And I emphasize the word work here. That's what cost control is. It manages the work. It doesn't worry so much about what invoices have been received and so on. That is part of the game. But you're really interested in what's actually been done. It's concerned with approving invoices of payment. Of course it's concerned with that because it knows what's been done. Therefore, it knows what can be paid for, which is not always the same with an accountant. They're interested in whether there's a piece of paper that says they can pay something. We're interested as a cost controller in whether work has been done. Concerned with ensuring forecasts remain within the project authority. I think that's probably one of the biggest aspects of a cost control as against accounting. You are really only interested in the future. You can't do anything about what you spent, but you can do a huge amount of what you're going to spend. And that's what cost control should be focused entirely on, in my view. It's the cost control married to the schedule. Those two things together, that's what makes cost control a service to project management. And ultimately, we make sure it actually stays under the budget. If you understand what the forecast is, there's a chance that we can actually end up in a place close to where the budget was supposed to be. That's usually quite good. And generally speaking, on projects where I've seen good cost control in place, that's exactly what does happen. They act as the conscience of the project manager and make sure he focuses his change control and keeps it managed. If you let change run away from you, if you keep saying yes to the client, it's amazing how quick you can run out of money. So finance concerned with invoices received against contracts, cash calls, they do look after the cash. It's quite important. We do need to make sure we stay solvent during the life of our project, but otherwise they look after that cash. We are going to go through these reasonably quickly because 2 hours, amazing how quick that time is going to go. Okay, my big thing about project control, and we are in a project control expo. Project control is really about management of databases. I know that sounds, it's nothing to do with project management. Project controls is about managing data. It's about making sure you know what is going on. I apologize with the glasses. I can't see the screen, or I can see you, one or the other. It's difficult to do both at the same time. But project control is all about making sure you know what is happening. The project manager has a feel for what's happening. The project controls team really need to know what is happening. Therefore, you do that by managing large amounts of data. Project control people have to get in their head that they are data managers. That's what you're doing. You're controlling the flow of information, and you're doing it in a structured way through databases. Once you've got that clear in your mind, you're way on your way towards the top end of a project controls career. So you need to build clear structures when you start on a project. Whether you're the cost controller, whether you're the scheduler, and you really need to be doing this together, you need to be getting up and managing those structures. So first one, work breakdown structure. Break down the whole of the job into the work you're going to do. The work breakdown structure, I've put there, next one is cost breakdown structure. That's to emphasize that the work breakdown structure doesn't have to be the same as the cost control structure. They have to be related. Most of the time, work breakdown structures are the same as the cost structure because you're using Oracle. And Oracle happens to call its cost breakdown structure a work breakdown structure. So the two names tend to get used interchangeably, but they're not really the same. You can have two structures as long as they're linked. And then you have the product breakdown structure, which is about what you're going to deliver. Maybe it's different to the work breakdown structure. I put it in there just as an extra structure that is commonly referred to. But most projects really only use the work breakdown structure and secondary, the cost breakdown structure. So, you want to know what a WBS element costs. That's what you're going to be looking for as a cost control. You know what? You want to know how much these things... You need to know the elements that are going into the WBS. That's what you need to put into your work breakdown structure. You need to understand how to break things down. So, for instance, where you've got design engineers, you wouldn't necessarily have design engineers on your WBS. That's where the CBS comes in. That's when you can code all of the design engineers and cut across. But you know that you've already linked the WBS to the CBS, so if you want to know what the cost of a single WBS element is, you can use the WBS to create that cost center or that cost focus temporarily. This is the whole thing about managing databases. You understand that if you've got a work breakdown structure and a cost breakdown structure, you can get different answers to different things, different questions, discipline. Using those questions there, if you think about how you structure your WBS and your CBS, you should be able to answer all the questions. Most of the cost management comes down to three things. Can't count either. What you're going to do, how much you've spent, and what you're now going to do. So the planned value. If you're doing earned value, this is that first curve that you create. This is the baseline. And a baseline is the current baseline. So every change you've made is brought into the baseline. So the baseline is what you're measuring yourself against. The actual cost is actual cost. It's sunk, it's past. You can't do anything about the actual cost. It is what it is. But the actual cost when you record it, has to be representative of the planned value. And we'll come to that a bit later. Determining exactly what the actual cost is that you put into your system is quite a precise definition, if you like, of what a cost controller is. And then forecast. That's the bit that the cost controller works best at. That's working out what money you're going to need, what spread of money you're going to need over the rest of the project. If you can't work that out, you aren't being a cost controller. You're not managing cost. You're just simply tracking what's going on. I've seen projects where all they manage is what did I expect to spend, what have I actually spent, and what is my EAC, what is my estimate of completion. I don't understand how anybody feels that that's control. That's just a figure. I mean, apart from anything else, it has no time in it. And time is money. So you have to have that profile. And a forecast is a profile. As a cost controller, you should be able to tell every week how much work has been done and what that represents in cost. And more importantly, the project manager, you should have informed, should be able to tell that information to his client because you've told him. We both worked for London Underground for a while. We had a great program manager. He used to make the project manager sit down in front of him once a month with the planner on one side and the cost controller on the other. Neither of those were allowed to speak, only the project manager. And if he couldn't answer the questions, they were in trouble. It was a great way of making sure that the cost controllers and schedulers really understood their relationship to the project manager. By the way, the project manager was in trouble for not beating them up and making sure he knew what this data was. But it really brought home to me when I saw him do it how much he wanted the project them to understand they were key parts of the team. So cost control, right-hand man or left-hand lady of the project team. So I'm now going to hand over to the professional in cost control to show you how it's really done.
I'm not sure about that. Okay, like I say, head of program controls at Tideway. This is a 20-whatever kilometre sewer running through the middle of London. It's £3.144 billion. And starting off, what do we want to do? We want to set a baseline. We want to say, how are we going to monitor the work from now to completion? So what you've got up here it's just a graphic. It doesn't matter too much what's on there. It's a graphic of the organisational breakdown structure that's in place at Tideway. So you've got program director on the side, you've got the chief operating officer, the chief finance officer, external affairs, director of HSSE and asset management. The thing with Tideway is a bit more than just a project. We have shareholders, we are effectively a business, we're a company. And we operate as a company that happens to be delivering a project, which is why it makes it a little bit more complicated than your normal just plain WBS. So what have we done with that? This is what we've called our program breakdown structure. So what we've said is we're delivering more than just a work breakdown structure, but everything that we do has to take cognizance of that work breakdown structure. On here, this is the top six levels of our what we've called the program breakdown structure. It goes down into level 9, so it's a bit more, but graphically you just can't get it on a page, it's massive. Just to give you an idea, even this picture on printed out on a plotter runs about 8 meters along the back of the wall behind my head. It's massive. The yellow is the work breakdown structure, so that's what everyone will know and love from delivering projects. The greens are those directorates that I mentioned, and then the blues are what we've called an IBS, which is not particularly a good name, but never mind. It's an indirect breakdown structure, so it's all the client support teams that are doing the rest of the stuff that's not related to the project. So what we've then gone through and done is the little yellow box you've got in the top there, that's just a representation of each one of the boxes that's on that program breakdown structure. We've got a risk register, we've got a cost profile, we've got a cost plan, and we've got a series of milestones that we've called, used the term of anchor milestones. Anyone that's been on Crossrail will probably recognise that term, I'm sure. So each box, we have that. So that's effectively, that is our baseline for every single box on that program breakdown structure. So that we can give the owner of every box real surety as to what it is that he's responsible for. So I'm one of the blue boxes, and my budget for the entirety of Tideway is pushing towards 30 million. So I have my register, I have my profile, I have my plan, and I know what I have to do to get to the end, and therefore I can be measured and are measured against that. Like I say, we're on Tideway, we've got our shareholders, we've also got Ofwat, we've got government, we've got the EA, we've got DEFRA, we've got many a party that want to understand what we're doing and how we're getting on. So in support of that, we actually have two baselines. We have our delivery baseline and we have a regulatory baseline. Regulatory one first, that's what Ofwat have given us, the 3.144 billion. That's what's in our project license. And that's what they will measure us as to whether we're successful or not against. On Tideway, we've now got all of our main works contractors on board. We are mobilising and we're getting ready to actually start the physical work. That regulatory baseline, as great as it is, it's a bit historic, and it was built by our teams without the support of the main works contractors. We're going through the programme for acceptance cycle at the moment, and at that point we'll develop and publish our delivery baseline, and that will be the baseline that we use for performance measurement on the project. And then against that we'll have our forecast, and we'll have our standard performance metrics that you all know and love. Just one little one chucked in the middle there is the current investment budget. That's what that's the financial side, if you like, of what we do in controls. So we've got a series of NEC 3 option C contracts. Also have the joy of dealing with inflation under the terms of our contracts. So what you have in this little graphic is it's just trying to give you how the regulatory and the delivery baselines combine. You have each of the delivery areas. On top of that, they have risk. On top of that, there's contingency. Then there's the indirect budgets that I talked about. There's literally as much as buying properties and buying land, as well as delivering work, office space and the like. There's another level of contingency and risk over and above that, and then there's inflation. So that's where the cost control or the cost profile comes in. Obviously, we pay money of the day. Everything was price-based last year. So if you say you're going to spend £100 million in 2016 and you don't spend it until 2017, it's going to cost you more money than you allowed for when you thought you were going to spend it in 2016. So there's an element of inflation and how much extra money is the project going to cost. Just to give you a quick flavour with the predictions we have at the moment, 3.144 billion, you could expect to put an extra £300 or £400 million on the top of that just from inflation. It's a big old number. There's a few little graphics there will tell you how we manage change and contract change and how it flows between the levels. It's quite complex. It's quite hard to put it in one of these slides. Okay. So what we're going to go on to now is structuring data. So we've spoke a lot about WBSs and PBSs. Now it's your turn. So we speak about the structure. It's the spine of the project. It needs to be thought out. It needs to have all the stakeholders consulted. But it needs to be pragmatic. It can't be too convoluted. It can't be need too much to manage it. And it needs to, the level of detail needs to be reflective of your team and the relevant level of detail you intend on managing the project to. So you might recognise that picture. This is the basis of the first question. You know who I support, so I'll leave it there. I can ask you to create a PBS or for the scope. Now this is Spurs' stadium, which will be, and it did pain me a little bit to have to go on the internet and research it and find out what they're doing. There's a scope of work there. Can you read that okay on the screen? Yeah. So what we would like you to do is consider what sort of structure you might require if you were setting up that project.
Yeah, structures are the key to putting a project and a WBS together and controlling your project. So we'd really like you to sort of, we didn't know how this was going to be laid out and how you'd sit down, to be honest. We'd like people to, if you possible, to get together in five or six to a table and discuss how you would structure your work breakdown structure, your PBS in this case. And then we're going to talk to you around the room and understand why you've done what you've did and see who's got a good idea. There's no right answer to this, so we just want you to trial it, and we're going to see how it goes from there. It was a bit of an experiment on us to put the work back onto you, but we thought you'd done enough of being presented too, so this is okay. So what a great networking opportunity to work with the rest of your table. Okay, let's make a start.
So what we have done is we have divided it into four main categories, stadium, ancillaries, leisure, and demolition. And then we have categorized the products accordingly.
Okay. Yeah. And sort of any reason for doing that? What did you feel that would give you the best advantage from structuring it like that? Was there much discussion, or did you just write it down and everybody else agreed?
It was a discussion. So it was a fair discussion around the table. So.
What made you base is on that breakdown?
Based on the core structure and the other activities involved in it.
Okay.
Just mainly looking at the products, what was being delivered.
Yeah, looking at the main products. Yeah. Okay.
You divided the requirements into that.
You divided the requirements into the structure and it works, yes. Do you think if they do a design review, it will survive that? It's a dynamic process, it will survive, yes. Well, basically you have got it into primary structures, so even if they change the delivery methodology, it should still retain its... I was actually being complimentary. I think it will do quite well. Okay, I'm going to move on to another table. Sorry, I've got to pick on different people. And that's, I realise this is a ladies' table, so the... ladies in project management. So who was looking after this table? Who would like to fight?
Okay, so we have decided to divide it at the first level, the demolition and then the construction and then the facilities and events.
You're right.
Because the demolition is site-wise as well as the facility and events, and the construction, we have divided the construction into different buildings and or areas. So at the construction, at the second level, we have stadium, public, hotel, health center, and supermarket and university. Yeah. And then at the third level, then we are looking for design, procurement, and construction, and the sequencing for the construction.
That's good. Now, I like the start of yours, where you put the demolition and the events at the back end. Yeah, those are distinct, and they're going. I mean, obviously, demolition is going to happen before anything else, and it doesn't. You don't do demolition in, well, I think in this case you wouldn't do demolition in phases. Although we are working on an airport at the moment. When we're there, the area is so big, you actually have to do the demolition in phases with the construction. So. But in this case, it makes separate. The only thing I'd
query is that when you get to the delivery stage, you've broken it down into the design, the construction. That's breaking down your WBS, if you like, by phase. That does work, and it's very good for a start of the project because people want to know how much the design cost. What it doesn't tell you is how much did this piece of the stadium cost, because what you then need to be able to do is to group the relevant piece of design with the relevant piece of construction. So then with a product breakdown structure, what you're trying to do is to divide it into products. So you'd say this, say the groundworks, which is the design and the works all together, would give you that would give you a true cost of what the groundworks cost. Now, all I'm doing is playing devil's advocate here as somebody who asks, how much did the foundations cost? And you can't answer the question if the structure is not right. So I've spoken enough, and Paul hasn't worked hard enough, so I'm going to pass the microphone to him to try the next two tables.
Okay, where are we going next?
We'll take it now.
Okay. Volunteer?
So pretty much the same as everybody else. We looked at the overall project and we broke it down into sub-projects. Our list is slightly different, but it would all be, you know, up for debate at a discussion. I think the important bit within each individual project was that you adopted a common WBS or CBS structure. So 0001 would always be the feasibility element for each of the projects. 0002 would always be the design, etc. 050 would always be the lifts, if there were any lifts, for example, etc., etc.
Okay. You're good. Thank you. Anyone else? Any volunteers? How are we doing for time?
Well, you're all right. We're doing good.
We talk fast, so you don't have to.
Pass some wisdom on us. This is Sal. He's on Tideway with me. He's gonna.
Okay. He's the view there for PBS, WBS, CBS. It's very fundamental things. It needs to be discussed prior to starting new projects to assess what you want to achieve.
How have you guys structured it then?
Firstly,
you need to hold the microphone a bit closer.
Sorry. Okay, we went firstly for the main core of WBS, defining what is site investigation, enabling works, design, construction, all the support is needed in the project. After is create subcategories to identify all the elements and phasing them as you build it. And TEC is when you go into enabling works, you put demolition, and after demolition, you see which building you are demolishing or what part of it. So you disaggregate, and you can find everything back and forth, what kind of reports you want to do, and create a matrix. But it is fundamental, you start for a core WBS, after it's escalated to the minimal details. As the way usually it needs to be done, sit with the planners, sit with the cost controller, try to make sure not making many changes. If the changes, it needs to be always aligned and work together. Because in the moment you start, costs are kicking in. So that's our approach.
Okay, thank you.
I think you have time for one more table. So we need
one
somebody
more.
On to the left. We haven't really.
Any volunteers?
Nobody will volunteer.
So a hand starting to come up here.
Right. Very simply, what you need to know is where, that's the geographical area, what are you doing, and by whom. And then if you cross-reference everything, that's the way we did it, you know how much your civils cost for the whole thing or for a particular area, how much a certain subcontractor costs for various areas, and then you can put it all together and you've got the total. It's very simple, you know, but the actual breaking it down is, we need another couple of weeks to work on that.
I appreciate that. That's why it's, you know, thought it would be a light touch, just a bit of fun.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Sort of thing. Yeah.
We did wonder about this. We could have told you what the perfect WBS was, but as it doesn't actually exist, or the PBS, it was easier to get everybody to talk about it. And we thought We weren't sure how much experience the people in front of us would have, but we knew it would be mixed. So I did get one really good piece of feedback from the tables over here was, yes, I work a lot on putting all the structures together. We put all the cost codes together. And then there was a very unfortunate word used at this point, don't book to the right number. And that is a biggest, probably where cost control, you spend more time trying to chase people who have booked or put their invoices against the wrong cost centre, and you're trying to get it transferred onto the right cost centre. If you want to know what a cost engineer spends most of his time doing, that's probably it, trying to work out what's gone wrong. They have a perfect solution. Unfortunately, people don't appear to work perfectly. I never understood that, but that's how it goes. Okay, we've got another little exercise further on, so we shall take another break. But for the moment, oh, by the way, we decided it's us say on the agenda that we're going to have a break. We're not. We're going to keep going, and when we are breaking for an exercise, that's your point. If you want to need to rush out and do anything necessary at that moment, that is the point you're going to do. So we're not going to be stopping as such. Okay, so we've done our first exercise. I'm going to now move on and talk a little bit more about some of the technicalities of cost control. Again, we're doing this in a very quick time, so I'm trying to hit some of the highlights. Hopefully, if you see the slide set, you'll be able to read through and understand it better afterwards. But we have put our email addresses on here, and if you are interested in anything we've said, please feel free to contact us afterwards for either an explanation or, you know, I even do job interviews if you're looking for them. We're always looking for people. I have to get something for standing up here. Okay, data cubes. One of my favourite words for the moment, data cubes. I like those. You'll have heard a lot about things like BIM and artificial intelligence and all that stuff. That's great. That's where the future of project management and all the rest of it's going to lie. But today, the thing you need to understand if you're in project controls is this term, a data cube. Now, to be honest, I only came across it myself a couple of years ago. But of course, I understood what it did some time before that, as you always do. I mean, even the term project controls, as most of you, maybe you don't realize, project controls didn't really exist 5 years ago because nobody had thought of the term. We were project support staff or the head of planning or something. But project controls, where it controls all of the data, that's really quite a recent term. And I think it's now reaching maturity. The fact is you can do an exam on project controls, so it must be mature. Now, a data cube is really taking all that data we've just talked about. So here you've got actual costs, forecast, budget, invoice, whatever. And you are cutting it by date, particularly. So every month, or whatever your reporting cycle is for your project, you're going to take a complete snapshot of the data, and you've got to be able to store it. The trick about the data cube is it's that forecast or that historical trend originally. When you take each month, you take a cut, and you use one of those sophisticated project cost control systems, you know, those ones called Excel. Each month you've got a spreadsheet which has got January, February, March, whatever. I mean, if 90%, I bet, all right, who in this room is not controlling their costs on their project using Excel? And notice that your manager didn't put his arm up.
I didn't. You weren't asking me, you're pointing that way.
Everybody uses Excel.
Using Access.
Oh, you're using Access. No, I know you're not. Spent enough money building the system. But what happens is people take snapshots of the data, and this is where Excel fails to actualize. And this is why you do need to go and use one of the proper project tools. This is where you start getting the advantage from cost control systems like the EcoSys, Prisms. I run out of that name after that. It's being able to put all of this data month after month behind each other and then drill through it sideways so you can get trends, so you can extrapolate, so you can understand how things are causing variations over time. I take all of the forecast data produced by our company for all of our projects, plot it month on month on month, tracking how it's varying, and what I'm looking for is variances away from a rate. So instead of interesting, I'm not interested in cumulative values, I'm only interested in how much per month did you spend. If this project spent 500,000 a month for the last 6 months, and its forecast is showing that it spends a million a month for the next 6 months, you know there's something wrong with that project. And it's only by having this trending information that you can actually make that analysis. So remember data cubes, look them up on Google. There's lots of data out there, or data, a lot of information about how to structure data cubes, but as a cost controller working in the project control function, understanding databases, this is something you need to study and understand, because it's becoming a standard term, particularly when you're being interviewed for some of these control jobs. So you better need to understand it. Okay, you're starting on a project. This is basic, this is 101 cost control, but this is what it's all about. I'm showing here a small bar chart, small Gantt chart, and I've put costs against each of the activities. This is where cost control deviates from the accountancy. You're putting cost over time. So for every activity, you've taken the money, you put it across an activity. You've now, and easiest way, by the way, is I would never profile costs across an activity. Individual activities on a schedule should be short enough that really you just put a lump of money on and assume a straight line. If you're ever doing anything more sophisticated than that, you're kidding yourself, really. So nice short activities, nice piece of lump of money, put on each one on there. So although I've showed a profile per curve, actually it's a straight line for every project, every activity, and then that gives you the profile for the whole project. Now, taking the schedule, cost loading it, and getting your curve, that's the fundamental aspect of the project. Everything is measured off against that curve. So even the schedulers measure their progress against that curve. It's they can't do it, though, without the cost controllers. That's why they're equally important. But it's also important that a cost controller understands how scheduling works. So it's quite good to get to know how to use Primavera or Microsoft Project. Well, Primavera anyway. So you've got your baseline. You've got that curve of where you expect to go. Now you have to be able to record actual cost. And the actual cost, the definition of actual cost, is unique, I think, to cost control. You have to have a value of actual cost that represents what you plan to do. So you planned a budget, but you didn't plan it on when you were going to pay the contractor. You planned it against what the work the contractor was going to do, how much the contractor was going to cost you, and you just amortized that value over that time period. That is not the cash flow that you're going to pay to the contractor. You're going to pay him what the work, we're not going to actually pay him, you're going to assign the actual cost to be equivalent to what he's achieved so far. So this is my definition. There is no absolute definition, but I use this one every time and nobody's really ever argued me. It's the direct costs. It's items that have all happened, so what you've received and paid for. It's all the contracts that are currently ongoing. It's all the materials on site. And I'll just look if I've got the next definition in. Can't remember my next slide. No, I'm sorry. So you just line, and so at the end of the day, you've got to work out what the value is of all of those. Theoretically, if you draw a line in the sand today, what would you owe all of the contractors? So as an actual cost is what do you owe? Not what your liabilities are, not what your penalty payments or anything like that. It's simply what is today owed. So you've got your plan, you've got your forecast, your actual, and now you've got your forecast. The classic one is my budget was £100, we spent 50, so therefore my forecast is 50 because I've spent half of it. It just isn't. You always got to be aware of what the work is to do. If you're a scheduler, You don't ask what percentage am I through this activity, you ask what are the remaining days needed to complete it. You could have a 10-day activity and 8 days have gone, and if the project manager is not going to actually do any work on it for the next week, he'll say, oh, it's going to take me another 8 days to finish it. You only do 2 days of work, but it's going to take 8 days to achieve it. It's the same with the cost. You only ever ask them how much more money you're going to need to finish this job. You never ask, you never talk to the team and say, well, you spent £200 out of the 400, how much more is it going to cost? Because they will immediately do the maths in their head and say, oh, it must cost us another £200. You've always got to be asking the team, how much more will this cost to finish, particularly the engineers? What are you going to be doing to finish this? Have they done any work to date? I've put up there about when. This is where the cost control and the schedule have got to be sitting next to each other, literally. The cost control has got to understand what's happening to the schedule. Obviously, it's a lot simpler if you put the costs on the schedule and you both work in the same environment. But a lot of cases, that's really tricky to actually make work in a real life, mainly because the schedule goes down to quite a lot of level of detail, and the cost control just cannot follow to that level of detail on a big construction program. So you tend to be at a higher level. So the cost control is a summary on the schedule. So you've got to be able to understand what the group up of that activities are. I told you being cost controlled is difficult. Everything about managing projects is difficult. The systems make it a little easier because you can handle more data, but at the end of the day, you as a project cost controller have to be able to put it all together in your head. So you have to understand how the schedule is changing underneath it, and that's what creates the forecast. You move your costs around with the forecast. Earned value is a term used extensively on projects these days, and there are lots and lots of books written about earned value. The thing is, very few projects really do earned value. Earned value is measuring what you plan to do against what you've actually achieved, and what you're measuring is the work you've done. What I've seen a lot of people do is they equate spending to earned value, which it isn't. It's not what you've spent, it's what work you've achieved. And to do that, you have to measure the work that's achieved. And I've got a little bit of a demo of this. So you've got this activity here, £3,000 spread over with a profile that shows you've got £200 a day for the first 5 days and £400 for the next. Now, you're halfway through, you're 5 days in and you're on target to finish within 5 days. You're not 50% complete. Do people get this? You're 30, in this case, your earned value is 30% because you've done 30% of the work. And this, when anybody asks you to do earned value, you've got to keep this image in your mind about it's the work I've done, not the duration of the time. So if you ever set, by the way, if you ever see a planner or asking you for what's the percentage time done on an activity, you need to fire the planner because that's completely pointless. That's asking a project manager, how far are you along in terms of percent? We all know the answer to that, it's 90. And it still will be 90 in 3 months' time. It's you've got to ask specific questions. So an earned value is about how much work have you done. So this is the two-slide introduction to earned value. I'm trying to get over the basic concept of earned value. But I say, in the UK, earned value is not generally done very well. Earned value can only work, by the way, if there is a sound baseline. So you've got a baseline curve. We showed a curve right at the beginning. If you know what that curve is and you keep applying the change control so it remains up to date, that's okay, because you can always compare that for your own value. I see a lot of where the baselines drift away. One of the trick questions we ask is, how many baselines have you got? And the answer was 6 in one project. That was quite good. You have 2, which is quite impressive, for good reason. So, statusing, you've got all of the activities. You've worked out what the budget is against them and you've put the baseline. And now you're into progress. So here, we're explaining that you've got that baseline curve, the planned value that was created by your costs, giving you that cost profile. Now you've put in the actual cost. Now the traditional accountancy approach is, how much did you budget against how much have you spent? Which is an interesting question in terms of cash flow, but tells you nothing about the project. All it tells you is how much you've spent it. Because you've not related it to doing any of the work, you don't actually get any idea of what the performance of the project is about. So you have to put in this extra line, this earned value. So when people are talking about earned value, they are talking about you taking that baseline curve, examining all the work that was supposed to be done against the baseline curve, and seeing how much of it you've actually done. And if you work that value out, because it may be less than what you planned, because I'm tending to show that in this case, this shows you an earned value curve lower than the baseline. So that's what you've earned. The actual cost can be whatever it is. In this case, it's showing it's high up. So the earned value, as it shows on that graph, is equivalent to the point on the planned value curve that you expected to done. You could argue that you're that far behind schedule, but of course this is a graphical representation of money, so you can't equate the two the same. There is a thing called earned schedule, but if you know anything about earned value, you'll dismiss it. For those of you who know anything about earned schedule. So, earned value, you have two variations. One is the schedule variance, and this is, now I'm presenting this to a cost control audience, because although it's called schedule variance, it's actually done using numbers. Okay, the cost controller would work this value out. They want to work out what's the earned value, take it away from the, divide the earned value by the planned value, and you get the index of the schedule performance indicator. It tells you how well the project is doing in terms of time. Basically, if it's less than one, it's bad, and if it's bigger than one, it's good. Then there's the cost variance, and here you're comparing the work you've actually done to how much money you've spent. You'll notice the baseline doesn't even come into it. It's about, so if you've achieved £30,000 worth of work, but you spent £50,000 doing it, that's not a good thing. That means you're poorly performing as a project, and that's where earned value is tremendous at showing that difference between what you're achieving and what it's cost you. And it has nothing to do with the budget. The budget, the planned value budget value, the only thing that's useful for is for the accounting team to keep enough money in the bank to cover the project. And if they get this scenario, they're in trouble. And that's why as a cost controller, you hope never to get into this scenario, because you're having to answer the questions about cash flow or delaying payment to suppliers and so on. So that's a completely different presentation. So here you're looking at difference between the actual cost, how much you spent, and the earned value, the true work of what you've done. Between the two of them, you get the CPI, cost performance index. And again, lower than one, bad, above one, good. So you'll get asked to put earned value management systems in place as cost controllers, as planners, project control people. And a lot of people fight against putting it in place. They always believe it adds work. The thing is, to create an earned value management system, you have to know what you expected the project to cost, you need to know how much you've spent on the project, you need to have a baseline schedule, and you need to know what you've achieved. That sounds to me like project management. It's nothing new, there's no data in there that you wouldn't have collected on the project in the first place. So therefore, why can't you do earned value? The reason people believe it costs a lot of money is because it requires discipline, it requires you to plan, it requires you to have a baseline that stays in line with the work you're doing. I've got a project at the moment working in London, and they're doing very well. They're delivering on time. But if you look at their dashboard, they have an SPI, which is their schedule performance, of 0.98. That means they are 2% behind schedule. And British, considering the work they're doing, is pretty impressive. Their CPI is 0.5. That would imply that for every pound that they are spending, they're getting 50p's worth of value, if you look at it that way. There's actually more of a story behind that one, because what's happened is that the client has issued them with lots more work and they've agreed to get on with it, but the client has not given them authority for all of this work. Basically, he hasn't signed the contract to spend the money. So they're getting on with the work and doing the stuff, but they haven't got any backup for it. And quite rightly, they have tracked the work they're doing, but they haven't included the budget in their baseline yet. So although they're 50% poor, you could argue, in their performance, the earned value is showing that, and it's making the client totally aware of what the scenario is. The crime with measurement in cost control or any other kind of project control measure is not knowing what it means. If you'd managed this project entirely on CPI and SPI, you would have fired the team. Actually, they've been winning loads of work, and it's really doing really well, and providing you ask the question. But they have at least recorded it truthfully. They haven't artificially bumped up their budgets. So does earned value cost? Well, as I was saying, so does poor performance. If you don't track it, it's going to be bad. Earned value has tremendous ability to predict the future. I think we can talk about Metronet these days. Some of you may remember Metronet. Metronet was a privatized chunk of London Underground. And we, first time we came across earned value, we put it in there, we applied it across all of the stations, and we demonstrated that the final cost, based on the earned value we had to date, was around 50% more than they were telling the client. So instead of going to be 600 million, it was going to be 950 million for this station improvement. We were told to shut up, the data must be wrong in any way, you're not telling the client. 2 months later, they made a formal announcement of a change of budget. It was 875 million. The earned value prediction was spot on. It was quite frightening how raw the data was, and you use the earned value to calculate. If you're going to keep on earning at this rate, that is what the final figure was. And I've seen that happen time and time again. You get poor data, you think, but it's amazing how accurate the trend is it showing. So earned value is definitely worth studying. And you'll understand that I'm passionate about it because I keep going on about it. And finally, that one, does it over-optimistic promises to the client. With earned value, you can't kid people how well the project's doing. If you use it properly, it's out in the open. What's your performance? The great thing about an SPI and CPI is it doesn't actually tell you the values. It just tells you the ratios. So you can openly declare them with your client, and the client will insist on seeing them. And if you use that and explain where you are, it's amazing how you can carry the client along through very bad periods. Whereas if you told him when you get too close to the end, oh, by the way, it's going to take another 6 months and we want some more money, please. They get less than happy about that. So earned value, early warning. So that was a crash course on earned value. We're now going to do exercise two, because after understanding what the budget is and how you're going to structure it, understanding how to change it after life happens is the next hardest thing to do.
I just want to add a couple of little anecdotes, actually, if I can. Indulge me while I have the mic. Something Simon said about finance and accounting versus controls, and it reminded me of the first board meeting that I ever presented at. And I'm there and I've presented on milestones and I've said, you know, we're missing a load of milestones, we're behind schedule. Presented all the earned value, it's all 0.9 this and 0.85 and, you know, we're in trouble. We're not achieving the metrics that we're supposed to be doing. The production stats are all down. Everything's terrible. You know, we're spending way more money than we should have done. Our financial controller was next up on the agenda and said, well, we've had a good month this month. We said we'd spend 11 million and we spent 11 million. So we're spot on our budget. I sat there going, what? You know, everything you've seen in the presentation beforehand has told you that we're having a really, really bad time of it. And our accountant sat there and said, oh, it's fantastic. What a great month. So.